Audio Journal is a radio reading service intended for a print-impaired audience. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hey everyone, this is Anna, and along with Nick and Chris, we would like to welcome you to Audio Journal Sports Page. This is a program by, for, and about sports, activities, adventure, and information involving people with a variety of disabilities. Okay, I'm going to start off my segment here with this article. It's actually an interview, and I found it very interesting, so I hope you do too. And it is titled, Ask the Paralympic Pioneers, Brian McKeever on para cross-country skiing. This week, some of the most decorated Paralympians of all time will answer your biggest questions ahead of the Milano Cortina 2026 Paralympic Winter Games. Get ready for the Milano Cortina 2026 Paralympic Winter Games. The Paralympic Winter Games return to Italy for the first time since 2006, gathering up to 665 athletes across six sports, para-alpine skiing, para-biathlon, para-cross-country skiing, para-ice hockey, para-snowboard, and wheelchair curling. This week, hear directly from legendary Paralympians as they answer your top questions about their sports. We spoke with Canada's Brian McKeever, a 16-time Paralympic champion turned coach, about everything you need to know about para cross-country skiing. Para cross-country skiing 101, the sport for everyone. Number one question is, what is para cross-country? We have three categories of para cross-country skiing races for men and women. These are standing, sitting, and visually impaired. Athletes with vision impairments would be competing with a guide skier. Number two, how did you take up the sport? I will blame my parents. I think it tends to be a family sport. People get kids involved at a young age. What did you enjoy most about competing? I enjoyed the training aspect of it. I enjoyed experimenting with training and then using the races as proof of concept. Next question, what were some of the challenges or difficulties you faced in the sport? I think for me, it was always just making sure that I can find motivation through the training seasons, because it's a lot of hard work and it's not always easy. Sometimes it's fear-based. If I don't go out there, then my competitor might be doing that work and will be getting an advantage. When it's nice, blue, sunny day and the ski tracks are beautiful, then you know that's when everyone wants to be out there. When you're a top-level athlete doing a sport as a job, it is difficult to describe it to people who do it for recreation. When it's recreation, you have a choice. You can choose not to go out there on the bad days, on miserable days, on days when you're not feeling very well or are tired. For training athletes, they don't. If you don't put in that work, you won't be competitive. Inside the Para Cross Country Skiing Playbook. Number one, can you tell about the strategies that you use during the race? From a tactical standpoint, pacing is important, whether it's a short break or a long race. Knowing when you can sustain, when you can accelerate, when you have to take a rest, what is the section of course where you have to be really focused or you'll lose time, and where can you back off and rest and not lose time? Second question, how did you communicate with your guide during races And what is the key to good communication? It has to be a team. Depending on how much vision the skier has will change how much communication and what the guiding strategy is. So for me, because I have some visual function, there wasn't a whole lot of communication within the race. Some check-ins. How are you feeling? How's the pace? Do we need to accelerate? And that was the main part of our communication. But for somebody who's completely blind, every time you take a stride, there's a noise being made. So it just might be, yep, 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 left, left. So those athletes are being guided every step of the way. Next question. How do para cross-country skiers train? May 1st is training new year, and from then until the end of November, there are big hours. The top skiers are doing 25-hour weeks, and the development skiers are maybe doing 10 to 18 hours a week. Then we'll try and find some training locations that are for novelty, to be away from home, to keep things fresh. That's why we are in New Zealand in August. For our team that lives mostly in Canada, the reasons we would leave Canada is to chase snow, to chase altitude. During the racing season, the volume comes down a little bit because there is more recovery time is needed between those races. Next question. How do para cross-country athletes keep their stamina? That's developed over years. 1 year does not a career make. Each year, those total training hours go up. As a junior, you're thinking, man, a 3-hour session is hard. At some point, I'm going to have to do 4, but it's not like it happens overnight. Stamina is built with those long sessions and multiple days in a row. What is it like to ski uphill? It's climbing. It's a power to weight ratio type sport. So people who have a little bit less muscle mass, more slight frames, they love going uphill. That's their favorite part of the race because they know they're going to do damage there. It's hard work. You can feel the power you're putting into your skis and poles equals rapid ascent. It's a bit of an addictive feeling. I enjoy that feeling. If I pushed hard, then it would be glide a long way up. It's a fine line because you'll have days when the climbs are not your friend, and those are hard days for sure. While you're losing time on the climbs, there's nothing you can do about it. Next question. How do you think Paralympic sport has evolved since you started? The competition has gotten a lot deeper. You used to see people coming into the sport with a fit background from something else. Maybe they were runners and they had an accident and then discovered skiing. You take a person who was new and in a few years make them competitive in the ski world. Before, there were maybe 5 people in a category chasing 3 medals. Now, there are 15 people in a category chasing 3 medals, and they're all competitive. What does it take to become a Paralympic champion in your sport? It takes focus, dedication, and sacrifice. It takes good guidance to slowly turn that heat up each year and provide new challenges and refinements to the athletes. It's also a very technical sport and requires learning how to be efficient. What do you remember most about Salt Lake City 2002, your first Paralympics? I remember my brother Robin coming with me as my guide. The second race, we came in well prepared. We ended up winning, and when we stepped off the podium, we kept our medals on for a little bit. It felt like we had achieved something. Robin turned to me and said, "When you started losing your eyesight, it was the year I came back from the Olympics. The first thing that hit me was, oh no, my brother's maybe not going to be able to have this experience that I just did. And I know now that I was wrong." He said at the Olympics, everybody's wearing your national jacket is your friend. But then at the Paralympics, everyone is your friend regardless of nation because everyone's gone through something. There's an understanding. There's an empathy. And that brings all these competitors a lot closer. What is your favorite Paralympic memory? Racing at home in Vancouver in 2010 Paralympics was a good one. All the family was in the stands, and basically, we had a family reunion. We can hear some of the loud voice cousins cheering. That was very neat. Counting down to Milano Cortina 2026. What excites you most about the Milano Cortina 2026 Paralympic Winter Games? The food and the coffee. I get to be on the other side of the fence now as a coach, which is awesome. I am really enjoying watching the athletes develop and want to see how well they do. What can fans look out for when watching para cross-country skiing? It's on a pretty hard course. I think there are opportunities for some spectacular physical performances and potentially some spectacular crashes because there are some fast downhills. I think there is going to be good competition and tight racing. Can you share a message for athletes who will compete at Milano Cortina 2026? Athletes going to the games just by being there, being on television, and having attention focused on them is an opportunity to be a representation to the next generation of kids coming up. They are going to be watching this and maybe see themselves reflected in the images they see, showing them that there is a possibility in a high-level sport for people with disabilities that is really powerful. Somewhere in the world, a kid is going to watch and want to do that sport, whether that becomes a lifetime passion, enjoyment, or whether it becomes a career. That doesn't matter. What a great article. Okay, next article is Hit the Slopes with Adaptive Skiing. If you or someone you love has a physical disability, adaptive skiing can be a great way to stay active in the winter. Adaptive skiing uses modified ski equipment that helps people with disabilities safely enjoy on the slopes, says Sarah Beebe, MD, PhD, a sports medicine specialist with Mass General Brigham and Spalding Rehab. Dr. Eby is the head team physician for the U.S. Winter Paralympic Alpine Ski Team and Adaptive Snowboard Team. Adaptive skiing, also called paraskiing, is a type of adaptive sport. People may participate in adaptive sports for fun or as an athlete, such as those who train for and compete in the Paralympic Games. Adaptive skiing is similar to traditional downhill alpine skiing, but allows for changes to equipment or rules. An adaptive skier may use communication systems. Adaptive skiers with visual impairments wear helmets with built-in two-way communication systems. This system allows the adaptive skier to communicate with their guide, who directs them down the slopes. Ski outriggers. A substitute for ski poles, outriggers have cuffs that go around the skier's forearms and mini skis instead of pointed tips on the ends. Ski outriggers provide 4 points of contact with the snow, which helps an adaptive skier change direction and maintain balance. Tip stabilizers. This clamp or bungee cord-like device connects the tips of the skis. Also called tip clamps or ski bras, the device keeps skis parallel so they can't cross. Tip stabilizers give adaptive skiers great control and stability. They can be especially helpful when one side of the adaptive skier's body is stronger than the other. Adaptive skiing methods. There are several different ways for an adaptive skier to get down a mountain. Common types of adaptive skis include two-track or 2T adaptive skiing. This type is the most similar to traditional skiing. You ski with each leg on a separate ski and use ski poles. Adaptive devices like tip stabilizers help with balance, speed, and turning. Three-track or 3T. A skier with one leg uses a single ski. They hold an outrigger in each hand to aid in balance. Four-track or 4T adaptive skiing. This approach is similar to 2T adaptive skiing, except the skier uses two outriggers instead of ski poles. Sit skiing. The sit ski has a bucket seat mounted on one ski, called a monoski, or two skis, a biski. A skier sits in the seat and uses outriggers to control movement and balance. A built-in shock absorber cushions the ride. Benefits of adaptive skiing. Skiing is a great outdoor winter workout that's good for your physical and mental health. When you're on the slopes, you're immersing yourself in nature, breathing the crisp air and spending time with others who support you, says Dr. Eby. Risks of adaptive skiing. Like traditional skiing, adaptive skiers can experience common ski injuries, such as ACL tears, concussions, knee injuries. Adaptive skiers may be slightly more prone to shoulder injuries because they rely more heavily on the upper body, said Dr. Elby. Proper training, including strength training and staying physically active in the winter, can help prevent these injuries. Getting started in adaptive skiing. Like traditional skiing, it takes time and practice to learn how to ski with modified equipment because adaptive ski equipment can be pricey. Dr. Eby recommends trying out different options before buying, as well as taking lessons. To get started, sign up for an adaptive ski lessons at Spalding Adaptive Sports Centers. The next thing to do is check out the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation Universal Access Program, otherwise known as UAP, for free or low-cost access to adaptive ski equipment and instruction. Contact Move United, a nonprofit organization that supports all types of adaptive sports programs throughout the country. Call your local ski resort and ask about adaptive ski programs. Paraskiing at the Winter Paralympics. Para-alpine skiing became part of the Paralympic Winter Games in 1976. The 2026 Paralympic Winter Games, which take place from March 6th through March 15th in Milano Cortina, Italy, feature five paraskiing events. There are three adaptive ski categories, standing, sitting, and vision impaired. Each event uses a timing correction system that ensures fair competition among athletes with different types of levels of disability. The five para-alpine skiing events include downhill. A skier races down the mountain, moving around gates, poles, in the hopes of having the fastest time. Slalom. A skier makes sharp turns between closely spaced gates on a short course. They compete on two different courses on the same day. The times for each run are added together. The winner is the one with the fastest totaled combined time. Giant slalom. Skiers race between gates spaced farther apart than in the slalom, but closer than the Super G, similar to slalom. Each skier competes on two different courses on the same day. The skier's scores are combined to determine a winner. Super G, short for Super Giant Slalom. This race combines the speed of downhill with the turns of slalom. The course is longer than a slalom or giant slalom with closely spaced gates. Each skier competes the course once. The faster, the racer, that's the one who wins. Super combined. A skier completes a high-speed event, either downhill or Super G, and also competes a single slalom run. The skier with the fastest combined time wins. Para-alpine skiing events are thrilling to watch and so inspiring, says Dr. Eby. These athletes don't let physical limitations stop them from doing what they love. I encourage everyone to watch the 2026 Winter Paralympic Games. So yes, we are looking forward to that. The second week in March, I think it's going to be very exciting. I'm very looking forward to that. Okay, it looks like I used all my time here on Audio Journal Sports Page, and I'm going to hand it over to Nick and Chris. So guys, I'm anxious to hear what you guys have for us. Take it away, guys.
Thank you, Anna. Hi, everyone. This is Nick, and I'll be reading you a few stories here for this week's edition of AJ Sports. The first article I would like to read is from the... what's the website here? The KiwanDailyCourier.ca. And the article is entitled, Curling Championship Creates Community for Visually Impaired Athletes. From Edmonton. The crash of rocks and the scratch of brooms has long been a part of Natalie Morin's life. She first stepped onto the pebbled ice of a curling rink as a kid more than 45 years ago. But the sport she loves has always had a twist. Morin is visually impaired, as are the people she plays with and against. Quote, everyone from totally blind to someone like myself that's very lucky to have good mobility vision, and everything in between, end quote, said Morin, president of the Edmonton Blind Curling Club. This week, Morin will skip Team Alberta, one of eight teams from across the country that have gathered at the Granite Curling Club in Edmonton for the 2026 Canadian Vision Impaired Curling Championship. Games started Monday, and gold medals are set to be presented Friday afternoon. Out on the ice, there are few indications that the athletes are visually impaired. Quote, the game is very similar to any other game of curling, and with slight modifications for people with sight loss, end quote, said event coordinator Corey Stuvey. Quote, a visually impaired curling team is four members. The lead is a totally blind individual or someone who only has slight perception, and the other three curlers are low vision. And really, the only modification is that we permit there to be a sighted sweeper, a designated sweeper out there, to take the place of the lead, who obviously can't sweep. Other than that, rules are the same, end quote. Some players use special equipment, such as binoculars or a light at the end of their broom, to help their game. Others use the audio cue of a teammate tapping on the ice to direct their shot. Quote, it's up to the individual. And of course, there's so many varying degrees of vision loss and all the rest of it, end quote. Stuvey said, quote, everybody's different and we adjust accordingly, end quote. Tailoring the game to each competitor's needs helps create an empowering environment where everyone can feel proud of themselves. Quote, it's an ability and an opportunity to demonstrate their abilities rather than focus on the disability. They're out, they're curling, we hear about curling, we see curling, and they're a part of curling. So it's sort of being a part of the real world, just participating and enjoying it and being among peers and achieving greatness, Stuvey said. As players filtered off the ice this week, some grabbed the harness of their guide dog, while others unfurled a white cane or grasped the elbow of a sighted companion. Many headed upstairs to the Granite Club's lounge, where they chatted with competitors from across the country. Quote, the tournament's an excellent opportunity for them to get out and compete, but also get out and get to know some people from their peer groups from different regions, end quote, Morin said. Quote, we've shared all kinds of non-curling stuff, technology stuff, that can help them in their daily lives. It's a really fantastic networking tool, end quote. This year marks the 18th time the Canadian Council of the Blind has put on the championship, and the first time the tournament has ventured west of Ontario. Quote, We thought, rather than having it stagnant in one city all the time, we'd roam it across the country, end quote, Stuvey said. And that way we can promote the support in local areas, and maybe get new potential curlers coming out and interested in sport, end quote. The last championship was held in Sydney, NS, where the Prince George Blind Curling Team took first place. The accomplishment was more than two decades in the making, said lead and founding member Terry Pipke. Quote, it took us 25 years to reach the pinnacle of blind curling, end quote, he said. Pipke and his team keep coming back to the Canadian Vision Impaired Curling Championship year after year, in part for the competition, but also for the community. The tournament's also just a lot of fun, he said. Quote, there gets to be the odd squabble on rules now and then, but that's neither here nor there, end quote, Pipke said with a grin. Quote, I enjoy coming back year after year and seeing mostly the same people and playing against them. And you win some, and you lose some, end quote. The next article I would like to read is entitled, Is Andrea Bocelli Blind? And it's from yahoo.com. There's a sports reason behind opera singer's sight loss, by Jackie Longo. There's no question that Andrea Bocelli will be the center of attention when he performs during the opening ceremonies at the Winter Olympics in Milan on Friday. Bocelli's voice is expected to stop time for a global audience of millions. But before the Italian opera singer takes the stage at the iconic San Siro Stadium in Milan, many fans continue to ask one question. Is he blind? The short answer is yes, but the reason behind the opera singer's vision loss might surprise you. At a glance, Andrea Bocelli was born with congenital glaucoma, but he was not fully blind at birth. He completely lost his sight at age 12. A brain hemorrhage was triggered by a soccer ball hitting his eye. Bocelli won't see anything when he performs at the 2026 Winter Olympics opening ceremonies. Andrea Bocelli wasn't born completely blind. He lost his vision in a freak sports accident. As a young child, the 67-year-old opera singer was diagnosed with congenital glaucoma, a condition that causes high pressure in his eyes, but he could still see colors and light. The Grammy-nominated singer, who grew up on his family's farm near Tuscany, Italy, always had limited vision, but it wasn't fully gone. Quote, I was considered extremely short-sighted. I could see everything, but only from up close, end quote, Bocelli shared during his 2024 documentary, Because I Believe. Quote, I remember extremely well the world I saw, colors, everything. How could I forget those memories? End quote. When he was 7 years old, Bocelli left his family's home to live at a school where other visually impaired children lived. It was there, at the age of 12, where he was hit in the face by a soccer ball while playing goalie. The freak accident resulted in a brain hemorrhage that destroyed his remaining vision. Despite his disability, Bocelli says it was his mother who pushed him to continue to chase his dreams and not let the impairment stop him. My mother was a very strong woman, he told Deadline. Quote, she couldn't have it if I went to her complaining about some sort of problem. How do I do this? How do I do that? She goes. Make do on your own. You can do it. That's it. No excuses. Figure it out. End quote. Being blind is just one part of Bocelli's life, and he says he won't let it define him. During a 2011 interview with The Telegraph, the Italian singer said, quote, it should be of no more interest than my blood type, end quote. Quote, people wonder if there is a relationship between my lack of sight and the way I sing, but there is no connection. Losing my sight had nothing to do with my focus on music, end quote, he said thoughtfully. The next article I would like to read is from, let's see the website here. Oh, my phone's a little frozen right now, but I think it's refreshing. Are you refreshing? You seem to be frozen on this page. Let's move on to another article for now. This is from goodthingsguy.com, and it's entitled Blonde Football Commentary in Johannesburg, Seeing the Game Differently. Excuse me. By Karabo Peter. From Johannesburg, South Africa. When you think of football commentary, you probably picture commentators with eyes glued to the pitch, narrating every pass, tackle, and goal. But in Johannesburg, a groundbreaking initiative is rewriting that narrative, and that's blind football commentary. Under the umbrella of Johannesburg Blind Football Association and supported by Corinthians Africa, visually impaired commentators are bringing matches to life for fans, proving that limitations exist only in perception. Corinthians Africa is a highly regarded nonprofit organization, NPO, and social enterprise focused on community transformation through sports, education, and agriculture. Blind football itself is a thrilling variation of the game. Played five-a-side, four outfield players wear goggles to ensure fairness across varying degrees of sight. The ball is equipped with bells, allowing players to navigate and strike using sound. They scream, "Boy," as they approach the ball. It's chaotic, thrilling, and they've got guides who help them to navigate the playing arena, end quote, Jack Misby from Corinthians Africa says. The commentary initiative officially launched in early February, inspired by the passion of people like Sibusiso Lukelo and Muduzi Lukelo, two brothers who, despite being blind, found their voice and narration over the game of football. Quote, "One of the guys would do commentary by himself at the stoop whenever I visited the Johannesburg Society for the Blind. He'd watch matches on Ukozi FM, mimic the style, and practice nonstop. I thought, why not give him a platform?" End quote. Early challenges did test them. Amplifiers and transmitters didn't arrive on time, so Jack improvised with phones and Bluetooth headsets. Quote, "We connected them to someone on the pitch who could see, and suddenly it worked. It was brilliant at first. It blew people away. You can't see, yet you hear everything and can commentate live. It was like Avatar, the connectivity. It just clicks," end quote. The innovation has a global impact. South Africa's blind football team and commentators have been invited to a World Cup in the United States this May, and they have turned to the community at large for their support. At the heart of it all is inclusivity. Quote, "This isn't only about sport. It's about proving blind people can be part of society, the economy, the Premier Soccer League one day. Why not?" end quote. The initiative also empowers participants in digital marketing, AI, and coaching. Volunteers are encouraged to help in all areas, as medics, cooks, content creators, or marshals guiding players on and off the pitch. The league's impact goes beyond the games themselves. Teams travel hours just to play, sometimes without proper kits, yet the community rallies to ensure they're ready. Blind football commentary is proving that vision is more than seeing, but it can also be creativity and teamwork breaking barriers. Okay, let's see if this article ever... Oh, the article is quite frozen. All right, the next article I would like to read is from GhanaWeb.com and entitled Ghana Blind Sports Federation Appeals for financial aid amid huge debt. The vice president of the Ghana Blind Sports Federation, Sarah Sirwa Asamoah, has called on stakeholders and institutions to come to their aid as the federation struggles with debt crisis. According to her, the federation organized a national goalball championship in Cape Coast for its members. The tournament brought together over 150 visually impaired athletes representing 15 regions, excluding the Oti region. However, they incurred losses after the event. She explained that despite financial support from the Ghana Gold Board, the Bank of Ghana, and the Ghana Ports and Harbors Authority, the costs of feeding and accommodation led to significant debts, which they are now seeking help to settle. These are images from our 2025 event where we hosted over 70 visually impaired people, and we incurred losses after the event. We had only 3 sponsors. Our budget was $400,000, but Gold Bond gave us $80,000, Bank of Ghana gave us $30,000, and GPHA gave us $10,000. We could not trace even 150, yet we had to do it. Our fear was that Gold Bond would take their money back, but we decided not to because we had already incurred losses. Accommodation and feeding were the reasons we went to see the director, and he advised us to do more social media publicity, Sarah Sirwa told Ghana Web Sports. The revelation also came to light when the Federation paid a visit to the Director General of the National Sports Authority, NSA, Yaw Mpofu Ankara, to introduce the executives, provide updates on the goalball championship they organized, and address the debts incurred during the event. Sarah Asamoah disclosed that the Federation owes the Egypt Blind Sports Association, EBSA, a participation fee of $14,500 for the 2023 African Goalball Championship. And as a result, the Federation can no longer participate in any international competitions until the debt is cleared. We owe $14,500 in Egypt, and because of that, we are not qualified to participate in any international games. The pressing issue is to settle the cost of accommodation and feeding, end quote, she added. All right, let's see about that other article. Let's see if it's even loaded yet. It appears it has not, but maybe I can read that during next week's edition of AJ Sports. So that'll do it for me. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll hand it off to Chris to finish off this episode. Take it, Chris.
Hello, listeners. It's Chris here, coming to you with a few more stories to round out our time together. First up, we're going to talk about how Paralympian Amy Burke fell in love with the unbelievably insane sport of goalball. Amy Burke remembers the tension of her team competing in the goalball final at the Parapan American Games in Chile last year, knowing that a win could secure a spot at the Paralympics in Paris, which we know it has. I was on the BM bench for the last little bit of the game, and every time I looked at the clock, I think only 2 seconds had run down. It felt like an eternity, said Burke, originally from Charlottetown, PEI, and now living in Ottawa. Burke is a longtime player on Canada's national goalball team, a sport which involves athletes with visual impairments trying to throw a ball into the opposing team's net. While that opposing team tries to block it with just their bodies, the teams wear blindfolds, listening for bells embedded in the ball as it jingles across the volleyball court-sized space. In Chile, Burke and her team secured a 4-3 victory over the U.S., winning Canada's first-ever gold in goalball at the Parapan Am Games after 3 consecutive bronze medals. It was an incredible moment, Burke told the Currents' guest host, Connie Walker. Burke was born with albinism, a genetic condition that affects a person's hair, skin, and eye color, and can often lead to vision problems. She will captain Canada's goalball team at her 5th Paralympic this year, but told Walker that she once thought the sport was too unbelievably insane to pursue. Here is part of their conversation. How did you get into the sport in the first place? With visual impairment, you get an itinerant teacher who kind of follows you through your schooling to make sure you have the right accommodations if you need them. And my itinerant teacher was on board for Parasport and Recreation PEI. He thought I would be a good fit, and they kind of approached me and walked me through the whole thing. I went to a couple of practices and thought it was unbelievably insane to throw a ball at you when you can't see. And I was only 12 at the time, so I was a little intimidated. I said, no, this wasn't for me. And then the next year, I don't know what happened, but it just kind of clicked that way, you know? I didn't really give it a fair shot. I loved the sport, and I knew the older I was getting, it was going to be harder to continue playing sport at a high level with fully sighted peers. So, I thought, you know what? I really should go give this a second chance. And I fell in love with it, and it has shaped my life drastically since then. Question. Your team was awarded the most trending moment at the Canadian Sport Awards last year after that victory in Chile. What does that mean to you, for the sport to find a bigger audience like that? Answer. The amount of media attention our team has been giving over the last year has been nothing but phenomenal. A lot of times when people hear that we're going to the Paralympics, and they always ask, what sport? And as soon as you say goalball, it's like a deer in the headlights. Nobody knows. Now, they've seen it on TV during the games in Santiago. They've seen the articles. They've seen the most trending moments. And people are now more aware. Being one of the only team sports for blind and visually impaired athletes, it's great to get this promotion because then we can get to those younger kids and continue to build our program. Because this definitely is one thing, and things we struggle with across the country is just recruitment. Question. What would you tell a young athlete, visually impaired or not, and who is hearing this might be looking up at you as an athletic hero? And Amy's reply, don't do what I did as a young kid. Like, I saw this sport, and I said no way. So, you've got to go give that thing a chance, and you have to try something that's different. And I'm so fortunate enough that at a young age, I went back and I tried it. Definitely don't give up on something because it seems different or it seems hard. One of the things for me, too, is I was already ashamed and embarrassed of having a visual impairment because I was the only one in all my schools, and I didn't want to be labeled as the different kid already for having albinism. But also, now that kid plays something really weird. I'm so thankful that I kind of got this past, but I would really wish it had come to that I would have just accepted it and been like, you know what? This is something that does look kind of cool. And I don't care what other people think. All right, now we're going to talk a little bit of soccer, particularly with the Paralympics in mind. How blind soccer is played at the 2024 Paris Paralympics. B1 five-a-side soccer is one of the breakout sports of the 2024 Paralympics. Biggest rule for the fans? Be quiet. The 2024 Paris Paralympics have shown the general public how vast, extraordinary, and too often ignored the world of sports for people with disabilities is. Among the events that has garnered the most interest is blind soccer, or more precisely, B1 five-a-side soccer, which demonstrates how visually impaired athletes are able to use extraordinary spatial awareness as well as speed, precision, and technique. Like all disciplines practiced by people who are blind or visually impaired, it is regulated by the International Blind Sports Federation, the IBSA, founded in Paris in 1981. Here's how it works. B1, five-a-side soccer playing field. There's a distinction between B2 and 3, five-a-side soccer, which includes visually impaired people, and B1 soccer, in which most of the players are completely blind. The Paralympics includes only the latter. B1 soccer is played on a rectangular field, the same standard as a five-a-side football, about 40 meters long and 20 meters wide. Along the length of the field are 1 to 1.3 meter high boards that prevent the ball from leaving the playing area. Players. Each team consists of 4 movement players, all of whom are blind and must wear a mask, and a goalkeeper, sighted or usually visually impaired, but must remain in his own 2 meter deep area, but can guide his teammates by giving directions when defending. When playing an attack, however, the movement players receive direction from an offense guide who is himself sighted and is located behind the opponent's goal. When the ball is in midfield, the coach can give directions to his team. Unlike traditional soccer, though, there's no offsides penalty, which keeps the game moving briskly. The ball in silence. It is essential that, except for the goalkeeper, offensive guide, or coach giving directions, no one speaks during the game. That's partly because the ball itself is constructed with rattles sewn between the inner tube and the outer shell, which allow blind players to envision its location through sound suggestions. Spectators are asked to remain in strict silence so as not to disturb the players, who must rely on their hearing, such as when one of the players signals to the others that he is making an action toward an opponent. The audience can cheer only after goals. Match length. Each B1 five-a-side soccer match is divided into two halves of 20 minutes each, with an intermediate break of up to 10 minutes. Now the history of the sport. It seems that the first five-a-side blind soccer competitions took place in South America, with Brazil being the pioneer. In fact, the first championship of its discipline was held in the country in 1980, and Brazil has always won a gold medal since the sport became a Paralympic discipline. The game spread to Europe a few years later, with the first European championship recorded in Spain in 1986. Since 2004, that is, since the Athens Olympic Games, B1 five-a-side soccer has been officially included among the disciplines of the Paralympics. In the 2024 edition in Paris, the men's tournament is being held in a temporary field built under the Eiffel Tower. All right, and coming up here, Paralympics fans learn when to be silent and when to make noise at sports for the visually impaired. Paris. A soft voice from the loudspeaker reminds the restless crowd, shh. The whistle blows. Suddenly, spectators fall silent and even the slightest noise echoes through the Eiffel Tower Stadium. Fans pack the stadium, but at times it's hard to tell. This type of ambience is unthinkable in most sports venues, especially in a sport like soccer, whose fans are perhaps best known for rowdiness. But this isn't ordinary soccer. This is blind football, one of the two silent sports at the 2024 Paris Paralympic Games. Blind football and goalball are for athletes with visual impairments. When sensory input is reduced in one area, other senses pick up the slack. Without sight, sound takes the center stage. The ball in both sports contains a rattle or bell alerting players to its approximate location. Players yell out to each other as they navigate the field, and fans are required to contain their excitement until the ball is out of play. Both sports cultivate an environment unlike any other. Without constant chatter and chanting fans, energy manifests as a steady focus on the field of play. Jefino Goncalves, Brazil's star blind football player, said through a translator that he and his teammates felt the crowd is also into the game and reacting to every moment, and that they felt the energy on the court. French fan Jade Sido, 18, said blind football demands a different degree of attention. He says, "My dad and I go to some football games," said Sido, referring to her experience at able-bodied games. "Blind football is very different, but at the same time, I am more focused." Fans not used to these sports may feel awkward navigating the new rules. To ease the tension, a goalball commentator lets fans know that they are when they are allowed to speak. Noise. A bit apprehensive at first, the crowd slowly increases their volume to cheer. During halftime and in between important plays, a runner takes the blind football field with a large sign that explicitly reads, "Get loud." Usually, cues like this build momentum among spectators who are already cheering. Here, they're truly instructions. Even with the official go-ahead, some new fans let their patriotism override decorum while others sit confused. It's kind of funny because I think people in the stands are afraid. They don't know when to cheer, but I know when in the game, said Alina Mason, a Paralympic goalball player who frequently supports her fiancé, fellow Paralympian and goalball player Callahan Young, at his matches. It's silent, I'll be like, let's go. People look at me, and I'm like, it's fine. I know when I can cheer and when not to cheer. In those moments when cheering is allowed, it is thunderous. Spectators from the Netherlands agree that when it happens, the applause is much louder than in non-silent sports. I have the idea that you are with them in the game when they score, said Dutch fan Jamie Kudus, 23, who never attended a silent sporting event before today. We all go crazy, like you did it, because they can't see what they're doing. That back and forth dynamic can also distract competitors. Jeffino expressed that it can be difficult to go get the ball if the crowd fails to be quiet at the right time, but he also said he is optimistic that these problems will start to go away as blind football grows in popularity. Jeffino said that as more and more people are getting used to blind soccer, the crowd will be getting used to the noise rules and learning the environment. One element that fans came back to again and again is that they feel their silence equates to respect, not only to the players, but to the sports themselves. It's different how they act and how they respected the players, Brazilian fan Joaquim Menendez, 15, said of fans in the Eiffel Tower Stadium. He attended a blind football game between Brazil and Turkey, which Brazil won 3-0. I think the energy is the same, added Zito, who attended the same game. Even though we have to stay silent, I can feel that people are still really excited to be here. Alright, for this one we're going to bring it a little bit closer home, near Rochester, New York. McCoy Jesuit's 25-hour relay raises funds to support blind athletes. Rochester, New York. This year, student athletes at McCoy Jesuit High School in Rochester returned for the 45th edition of their 25-hour relay. The annual event, which began in 1979, was originally conceived as a way for the team to reconnect during the summer. This year, however, the event took on an even more meaningful purpose, raising money for blind athletes in upstate New York. Head cross-country and track and field coach Todd Stewart reflected on the event's origins. This whole event started back in 1979, said Stewart. It was just a few of the captains who had this idea as a way to get the team back together for the summer. The funds raised from this year's relay will support Upstate New York Blind Recreation, an organization dedicated to helping blind and visually impaired athletes compete and be part of a community. Max Schneiderman, the cross-country captain at McQuaid Jesuit, emphasized the importance of this cause. In New York City, it's really common for people to be able to compete in athletics. But with a smaller population, it's not as easy for them, said Schneiderman. So, Upstate New York Blind Recreation gives them that opportunity. For 25 sleepless hours, the baton kept moving around the track as students ran in shifts. With tents set up and sleeping bags at the ready, the McQuaid Jesuit community came together in a shared effort to support the cause. We've got a baton going around the track. It stays going around the track for 25 hours, Schneiderman said. People will walk, people will run, people will crawl if they can. They get a whole lot of help from a whole lot of candy. These guys go on a sugar high like none other, Coach Stewart added. The event wasn't limited to just the student athletes. Blind and visually impaired runners also participated, running with guides to raise money for the cause. We just had 5 blind runners on the track with guides, so if you can run, you can go, Schneiderman said. Jamie Weedman, a blind athlete who participated in the relay, shared her personal connection to the cause. I ran track in high school, starting at the School for the Blind in Kentucky, she said. What I loved so much about that was we would compete against other schools for the blind throughout the country. The relay is great, but what I think is very important is that it's raising money for blind athletes. The event was a community effort, with supporters from the area joining in as well. The goal was to raise $3,000, and that goal was met. Schneiderman summed up the spirit of the event. It's so much fun seeing all these people getting their opportunities to come out and run, especially with people that can't always run so easily, and they might need a guide. I love running, and I just love to spread that joy. All right, we're going to wrap up going back to the Paralympics. former Rice University swimmer looks to be a role model for disabled athletes across the globe. Competing in her second straight Paralympic Games, former Rice University swimmer Ilea Ladenburger is not only looking to represent her country on the global stage in Paris, but also aims to be a role model for athletes with disabilities worldwide. It's so important to me to be able to represent athletes with disabilities and the kids with disabilities everywhere, Ladenburger said. Growing up as a kid with a physical disability, I didn't really have that many role models that looked like me. I didn't even find out about the Paralympics until I was 12. So I just wanted to be a role model for them and showcase the power of disability. Disability doesn't mean you have to be a bad thing. It can be your superpower. Ladenburger, a 2020 Tokyo Paralympic Games silver medalist, a 2022 World Paris Swimming Championships bronze medalist, and a 2023 Paris Swimming Championships silver medalist and Marshall Scholar, headed to Paris on August 16th to begin her journey for competing in the 2024 Paralympic Games. She qualified in the women's 400-meter freestyle and the 100-meter breaststroke at the U.S. Paralympic Team Trials in June. Ladenburger is one of 21 women and 12 men who will represent Team USA at the Paralympics, which begin August 28th. Ladenburger recounted her experience in Tokyo during the COVID-19 pandemic and previewed what she's excited to see in an environment where there will be fans and crowds to go around. Ladenburger says it's such an honor to represent not only the U.S., but also Rice University, and just being able to compete for all the people that have helped me get here. It's truly such an honor, and words can't describe what it means. You've been listening to Audio Journal Sports Page, our effort to look at sports from a different point of view. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or your iPad. This is Chris, along with Anna and Nick. If you have any information on any disabled sports and would like us to share it with our listeners, give us a call at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is The End by A.A. Milne. When I was one, I had just begun. When I was two, I was nearly new. When I was three, I was hardly me. When I was four, I was not much more. When I was five, I was just alive. But now I am six. I'm as clever as clever. So I think I'll be six now, forever and ever. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal and read by me, Nikki Whichello. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with poetic wonder.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.